We'll turn over to James. James 1, starting in verse 13. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, and he himself tempteth no man. But each man is tempted when he is drawn away by his own lust and enticed. Then the lust, when it hath conceived, beareth sin, and the sin, when it is full grown, bringeth forth death. Be not deceived, my beloved brethren.
If there's a room in your seat, open to number 83. If there's not room, then it's okay. But just coincidentally or providentially, however that works out, we're going to be studying about temptation this morning, and that song really said a lot of things we're going to talk more about. And actually, I meant to do the same, so I didn't have this in my notes, but I'd like to just refer, if it comes to my mind as I'm going through the lesson, some of the things we sang together there. In Matthew chapter 26, in the garden, you recall Jesus prayed, O my Father, if it is possible, let this cup pass from me, nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will. And this reflects, you could compare that with Jesus' instruction in Matthew 6 and verse 13, lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil, from the evil one. We studied that passage, I think, last week or the week before. So compare those. Here Jesus says, lead me not to the cup, and yet let your will be done. Jesus drank the cup, and he did so without sin, and yet in that process he overcame the cup, and he overcame every enemy who contributed to pouring that cup and bringing it to him. And so he was led to trials, to temptations, and yet he was delivered from the evil one. What was your cup this week? As we sang number 83, in the hour of trial, there can be a variety of different kinds of trials. And so maybe your cup this week was some kind of hardship, maybe ongoing, maybe unexpected. Maybe it was more of the temptation type. And so just in your own review and thinking about your week and Jesus' words, on those occasions, whose will was done? Because God had a purpose and a plan for what happened. Satan had a very different purpose and a plan. Whose will was accomplished this week? In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse we often reference, 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, no temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man, but God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape, that you may be able to bear it. And so this passage accompanying Jesus' teaching regarding prayer in Matthew chapter 6 remind us that God promises not to keep us away from temptation all the time, but he does promise to deliver us from the sin, from temptation in that sense. And so this morning, I want to think about the fact that God is faithful, and then our faithfulness in finding the way of escape. We're going to look at five areas in which God directs us to find the way of escape. The first is in regards to the instruction of Jesus in Matthew chapter 6, and this is just, of course, the role of prayer. The role of prayer in helping us find the way of escape. As we read in James chapter 1, we're not tempted, of course, by God. God never tempts us to sin, but for the purpose of strengthening us, he will lead us to a place where he knows Satan will tempt us. The 23rd Psalm, he leads us through the valley of the shadow of death. He leads us to difficult places. And so in anticipation of that, then Jesus gives us this instruction to appeal to God's help even before those things happen. We certainly, as we sang in the psalm, God help us when that hour comes. And so when the hour is there, that prayer, a different kind of prayer, is certainly proper. And then even after that hour has passed, then prayer has a very different role. But think about the purposes and the blessings that prayer, and specifically in regards to temptation to sin, think about the blessings of that. Number one, asking for God's help strengthens and reinforces humility in us. And we all have plenty of things that counteract humility. And yet Jesus said the poor in spirit are those who are part of His kingdom, an essential trait of being in the kingdom of God. And so when we make this request on a regular basis, it's a constant admission of weakness. And the more that we think about the opponent that we face, then the more that we realize how outmatched we are just in your own life. How long have you been fighting against Satan? And at best, among us, several decades. Well, how long has Satan been crafting his methods? More than just a few decades, thousands of years, he's been engaged in the battle that you and I have only been engaged in for a short amount of time. So we are overmatched. That ought to reinforce humility in us. And then praying for God's help reinforces that as well. Related to that, it's an expression of trust. Jesus talked about that relationship between a father and a son in Matthew chapter 7 and verse 7. That if a child asks for bread, the father's not going to give him a stone. If he asks for a fish, he's not going to give him a serpent. The child knows who to ask because he knows who he trusts. And so the prayer of Jesus, God lead me and deliver me, it's an acknowledgement. I have my plans. We all have kind of our general outline of what's going to happen today and this afternoon and this evening. But then this is a reminder, there's all sorts of things that along that path, the route may change, or I may stay on that route, but there may be obstacles that I have no way of anticipating, and God is leading me along those. That's an expression of trust, that God, you're leading, and so I will follow. And then third, it reminds us of reality. Look at Ephesians chapter 6. And verse 12, when we think about the things that, again, reviewing our own lives and temptations, we think of the visible things that contribute to those temptations. And yet we need God's help and we need God's knowledge to know that there's a part of this battle that we can't see with our eyes that is not visible. And so here in putting on the whole armor of God, Paul exhorts us and reminds us, we do not wrestle against flesh and blood. Now, there is flesh and blood involved in the temptations many times, and that's the most obvious visible part. But Paul goes on to say that really the battle is against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. It's a battle of ideas and desires, that's true. But those things don't exist in a vacuum or independent. We're in a battle against real beings. And Satan is he's a real being, but he kind of represents all of them. He's the lead of that. But this verse says we're out numerically. We're outnumbered in a sense. If we're trying to fight by ourselves, we can't even see all of the opponents that we have. And prayer helps to remind us of that. And every day and every generation and every nation needs those reminders. But as we reflect on some of the history of our nation, and I'm not the most qualified to do that, but to some degree, in the past, people in our country had, I think, some things that reinforce that there is a reality and there is a battle that we're involved in. And in some obvious ways and in some even subtle ways, there were reminders of that. Even something as simple as some television shows or sitcoms in the past, they would have some reference to prayer or Leave It to Beaver going to church on some occasion. Even if some reference, even the whole show didn't revolve around that. But there were just things that showed, well, this is just a part of our society, that our society understands there's this other reality that we can't see. And yet, even in entertainment today, most of those even subtle references, they are removed. So there are a few things in our society that offer us a reminder of this reality. When you then look at those of some degree of religious mindset, they're even moving away from reminders of the reality of Satan and of sin. Did you hear this past week or the week before, the Church of England, two of their archbishops released a statement that was simply a statement of their teaching, that sexual intercourse is only approved by God in marriage between a man and a woman. These archbishops made that statement. Then a few days later, they apologized for it and said, well, we realize this broke trust and this brought pain to people who heard it. The church wasn't changing their teaching. I think they may be evaluating it in some kind of special meeting right now. But they weren't apologizing because we've been wrong all this time. So the teaching didn't change. But they apologized for stating what they teach. Just one indication. There'd be, of course, dozens, if not more, illustrations like that, that people are backing away from the pain, the injury that God's Word is intended to offer us, that reminds us there is sin and there's a battle going on. And Christians are not immune from being affected by that. Even sometimes Christians can be queasy about identifying modern religious error specifically and publicly. And I've even heard some Christians, well, they prefer, let's just keep the public teaching positive, and if we have to talk about error and condemn and identify things specifically, let's just do that more in a private setting. What do you do with the Sermon on the Mount then? When Jesus said, unless your righteousness exceeds the righteousness of some unnamed people. That's not what he did. He said of the Pharisees. And in Matthew chapter 6, he talked about the heathen. Don't let your prayers be like the heathen. What? Jesus didn't issue an apology the next day for that. He spoke the truth. He spoke the truth in love. Jesus can't even be condescending because he is above everyone. But he did it in a way that could teach and admonish and instruct, could convince and rebuke and exhort. He did all of that. But our society likes to accentuate the positive and ignore and pretend the negative doesn't exist. And my point here is that prayer helps us to keep that balance and to remind us, in the absence of very many other reminders, of the reality that we are in a fight against evil and the evil one. Finding the way of escape requires prayer. 1 Peter 5, verses 8 and 9. Be sober, be vigilant, for your adversary the devil walks about like a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. Resist him, steadfast in the faith. Just a couple of reminders of these words, sober and vigilant. The word sober literally means to abstain from wine. In this case, it's used more in the figurative sense, an application of that, of being sober or having self-control. And a good illustration of that is in 1 Peter 1 and verse 13. He says, gird up the loins of your mind and be sober. And that's also almost an applied definition of sober, being gird up, prepare your mind for action, for attentiveness. Have your mind prepared and controlled so that you can be vigilant, so that you can be watchful. And that's what, you remember, Jesus told the disciples, watch and pray that you enter not into temptation. So we, in our own kind of slang, we might say things like, be awake and alert. That's the idea of be sober, be vigilant. You've got to be aware. And then the perfect illustration of if you're not paying attention, somebody else is paying attention. And somebody else is paying attention to you specifically, and not because he's watching over you for your good, at least not the devil. His purpose is to devour you. Be awake and alert. So the importance of that, how am I going to find the way of escape? Well, first I've got to know that I need to escape, that there's a specific decision. In one sense, we're always trying to escape the devil, but this is more in a very specific sense, that now is the time when the enemy is visible, but I've got to be watching in order to see him. So we already noticed we can't literally, visibly see our enemy. So what are we looking for? Well, we've got to be looking externally. Satan is going to attack us from the outside. And everything that we see and that we hear is a potential source of ways that Satan would attack us. And we have to be awake and alert because of his subtlety in those attacks. As we Wednesday were discussing Genesis 3 in some detail, we do well to remember the subtlety of Satan, that Satan doesn't always tell a lie. He's the father of lies. But what he said to Eve, not all of that was false. He said, you'll become like God, you'll be wise, your eyes will be opened. And that appealed to her, and that was true. And so we have to watch for, be aware of, what am I seeing? What am I hearing that doesn't come from me, but comes from others? Those are potential sources, and they can be subtle. Statements like, well, you know, I mean, are you against celebrating Jesus' birth? Are you against celebrating Jesus' resurrection? Of course, we'd say no, and if that's the justification men give for having their holy days that are elevated alongside or above Jesus' holy day, today, the first day of the week, the memorial of his resurrection, it's not an annual day, and there's no holy day of any other event of his perfect life on earth. But that's subtle. That can on a surface level make sense. Well, oh, we're not against Jesus' birth, so why would we be against the so-called holy day of Christmas? And so that just illustrates externally we have to watch. We have to have self-control. We have to be prepared for Satan's external attacks. There's also the attack that comes inwardly. The things that, because we live in a world where there is sin, where there's explicit, and then even where there's more subtle forms of influence, things get into our mind, primarily through our eyes and our ears. And that requires us constantly evaluating. What am I thinking? What am I planning? What are my purposes? Where did I get those ideas? Where did I get those motives from? We can hear gossip all around us. And so that means we have to guard, well, what's my purpose for what I say? Because talking about other people isn't always sinful. If I'm going to get advice sometimes on how to help someone, sometimes I need to talk privately with someone to prepare for that, to be able to help. So just the fact of talking about someone else isn't gossip. It doesn't have to be. And yet, sometimes the very same words could be gossip or not gossip, just depending upon the purpose and the intent. And so that requires me not just to measure the words that I speak, but to go another level deeper and be sure I know, what is my reason? What are my purposes? That requires being awake and alert. First, to recognize the attack, and then obviously to be able to recognize and to follow the way of escape. God is faithful, and so if I know I need self-control and to recognize the way of escape, then God provides faith. And to faith, add knowledge, and to knowledge, perseverance. And the perseverance, I may miss a few things in there, but self-control. God's trying to equip me, not just in the moment, but ahead of time. He's saying, here's the armor. and put this piece on and put this piece on, because if I'm blinded by hatred, contentions, jealousies, outburst of wrath, selfish ambitions, those among the works of the flesh, if I'm blinded by those things, which are among the opposites of self-control, then I won't see the way of escape. I won't recognize the attack. I'll be participating in it, and then I won't be able to recognize the way of escape. And so growing in self-control, sobriety, and then being watchful, this is a part of God's plan to escape temptation. Next, we already read from James chapter 1, verses 13 through 15. Another part of finding the way of escape is being aware of my desires. I won't reread it, but I want to go back through verses 14 and 15 and just notice the process he gives here. He kind of gives the system of how sin happens. And so notice he talks about we're tempted. But what happens, what is there before temptation? What makes temptation tempting? Desires. So you start with desire, and then you're tempted when you are drawn away by your desire. That idea of being drawn away, it's that idea of being dragged away, pulled away. So you're dragged away, pulled away, and enticed. Enticed is being that idea of being caught by bait. So you're pulled away and the desires are pulling you away. And then when desire has conceived, stop there for a minute. He's using the literal language of the sperm and the egg here of conception. So what's being combined here to give birth to something? Well, my desire when combined with my will. There's always desires, but we don't always act on them, agree to them, accept them. But when my desire is combined with my will, a sinful desire, I should add, then it conceives and it gives birth to sin. And then sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So just in looking at that general process that he described, and you could go back to Adam and Eve, and the very first sin, and you could see this process, and we can review our own lives and see that same process. So if I recognize this starts somewhere, we see where it ends, and we don't want to end up where that ends. So where do I need to focus on in this process? Where do I need to pay? If the process is going on, I need to pay attention to whatever is happening, but where's the best place to work on to avoid ending up with sin that brings forth death? Well, start at the beginning. And so that is my desires. Being aware of my desires is a part of finding the way of escape. And that's going to be, to some degree, different for all of us, at least in specifics. So again, with yourself, what are the desires that most easily, most commonly lead you to action? What are the desires that you most easily, most quickly act upon? And again, it doesn't mean that we just have one desire. We all have a variety of desires. But just to illustrate that, not in a sinful context, think about the desire to eat, hunger. That's an ongoing desire. It may settle down for a little bit, but it's always going to come back. But do you eat every single time that you're hungry? Probably not. The world can't stop, even if you work at the cookie jar. The world can't stop every time that you're hungry. You may be hungry, but I'm in the middle of a workout. I can't stop. I won't be able to finish. I won't be able to continue. And so that desire may help me finish my workout a little bit faster. But my world can't stop. I won't be able to hold a job if every time this desire comes up. What happens when a desire arises is I have to consider, well, what are some other desires? And I may feel most strongly about one desire, but I have to think more strongly about other desires, and then I have to make a decision. And so that is a process we go through since we were in James. Just continue on in James chapter 1 and verses 19 and 20 for an example of competing desires, and then one has to dominate. He says, "So then, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath, for the wrath of man does not produce the righteousness of God." So, several things. Swift to hear. So, there can be two choices there. I can be swift to hear or slow to hear. I can be slow to speak or swift to speak. I can be slow to wrath or swift to wrath. And I could think about each one of those. What's the desire that drives me to be swift to hear? And what's the desire that drives me to be slow to hear? What would be the desire that would compel someone to be slow to speak? What would be the desire that would compel someone to be swift to speak? And then slow to wrath or swift to wrath? Now, we might could describe those desires in different ways, but what he says in verse 20, there's the righteousness of God. So someone who desires the righteousness of God, that's going to compel them to be swift to hear. Someone who desires the righteousness of God, that's going to compel them to be slow to speak. That's going to compel them to be slow to wrath. And each of those, hearing and speaking and wrath, those can fire very, very quickly and be very strong alongside a whole other variety of desires. So what do I have to do if I know I'm going to be caught in the temptation to not be swift to hear, not be slow to speak, not be slow to wrath? I have to be aware of my desires. And James talks about a whole host of other things, a very obviously practical book. He talks about chapter 2, partiality, neglecting the needs of brethren, cursing. In chapter 4, anointing myself as a lawmaker. So what are the desires that lead to those actions? He also talks about humility. He talks about prayer. He talks about at the end, James 5, 19 and 20, if a brother wanders from the truth, someone being willing to turn him back. So what are the desires that would lead to action in those areas? So that's the point, is what are my particular desires? Those that are right, those that are wrong, even those that are neutral. We all have some that are stronger than others for a whole host of reasons. You just think about that for yourself. And the more aware you are of your particular desires, that is going to help you in finding the way of escape. James chapter 4, verses 6 through 10 helps us to find the way of escape. But he gives more grace, therefore he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep. Let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and he will lift you up. So what helps me to find the way of escape? We could say the willingness to submit to God, to resist the devil, to draw near to God, and then think of a few specifics. Think about in regards to my presence, where I go. Psalm 1 and verse 1 talks about our presence. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. So that talks about the blessings that come by someone who has some discrimination, some discernment about their presence, who they're with, and what they're doing. Have you ever been somewhere and maybe you didn't even mean to end up there? You weren't the one driving. You were just with a group of people. you ended up somewhere, and while you're there, this is not somewhere I need to be. Remember in high school, before a football game, a friend of mine said, "Hey, some people are coming over to the house for the game. You want to come over?" So it sounded innocent enough. I get over there, and they're watching a movie. Didn't need to be watching, and so I just kind of froze for a minute. Wasn't expecting that, so I go back to a back room. Like, there's a video game, and so I'm kind of playing video games, like figuring out what am I going to do, and I think a couple of them felt sorry for me. They think they kind of rotated going back and playing video games with David. But at some point I realized, and I needed to realize sooner, I didn't need to be in that house. And so I finally made my way out. But I still reflect on that and kind of shudder. What if I didn't leave? What if I stayed and watched with them? Our presence, where we are, is, and thinking about where we are is a part of finding the way of escape. And there are a whole host of those kinds of occasions in our society, and especially that are available to our young people, promoted by various ones. Lewd dancing is just a non-issue in our society, and so schools put on prom and other things, occasions for lewd dancing. How do I find the way of escape? Well, I think about my presence. Can I draw near to God wherever I am? And that doesn't have to mean just worship. It doesn't mean everywhere I am I have to pray and sing and read my Bible. But am I in a place where I am and can resist the devil? And where I am, I can submit to God and draw near to God. Thinking about those simple things is a part in number 83 that we sang. Bring to my remembrance, sad Gethsemane, or in darker semblance, cross-crowned Calvary. Am I in a place where thinking about Calvary contradicts with what is going on and what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing? Finding the way of escape means thinking about my presence. It means thinking about my eyes. Job 31 and verse 1. Job, as he's reviewing his life and his not arrogance, but his confidence that I've been faithful, I'm not being punished because of some sin. And so among the areas of potential sin, he says, "Well, I have made a covenant with my eyes. Why should I behold a virgin?" And he doesn't say, "I can't look. Another woman can't be in my field of vision." But the idea of focusing on and dwelling on and thinking on, guarding your eyes, making a promise, a covenant with your eyes, that's an important part of being able to find the way of escape. Again, because we've been looking at the garden, what was one of the ways in which Eve failed? It wasn't just that she saw the tree. She had seen the tree before. I guess I'm assuming that. But God didn't say you can't, it's a sin to look at the tree. But when she saw that the fruit was, it wasn't just that it was in her field of vision. She was looking at it and imagining, oh, what would it be? How great it would be. That's the opposite of a covenant with my eyes. I'm not going to find a way of escape if I have not made a covenant with my eyes. Because once something is seen that's attractive, once something that is attractive is visible, it's very hard to look away from that and to look at something that is invisible. Not impossible, not easy, but have you learned to do that? Hebrews 12 tells us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. Yes, that's a general concept, but it certainly has application here. There are times where something is visible and attractive, and I need to look away from that in order to look to someone who is invisible. Or as Moses is described as doing in Hebrews 11:26. When he recognized the passing pleasures of sin, it says that he looked to the reward. Now, that's a great statement to look at the faith of Moses. That's a hard thing to do, to have in your sight the pleasure and to look away from what is immediate and easy and attractive and to look to something that is not immediate, that is not even visible. But that's a part of finding the way of escape. With my eyes, resist the devil. With my eyes, draw near to God, looking unto Jesus, looking to the reward. But when I do it, then God's will is accomplished. I'm strengthened every single time that I do it. And then one other. Think about the role of our thoughts in finding the way of escape. In Proverbs chapter 4, verses 20 through 23, Solomon writes this from the perspective of a father, like giving advice to his son. And he says, "My son, give attention to my words, incline your ear to my sayings. Do not let them depart from your eyes. Keep them in the midst of your heart, for they are life to those who find them, and health to all their flesh. Keep your heart." That word keep means guard. "Guard your heart with all diligence, for out of it springs the issues of life." Your heart is where those desires that we talked about in James 1. Your heart is where those desires die, or where those desires that where they decrease, or where they increase, or where desire conceives. Desire grows or weakens or conceives or dies in your thoughts. And so think about what makes up your thoughts. Well, those are things that, again, it usually gets down to what you've seen and what you heard. That creates the substance of your thoughts. And then you've got desires. And when those conceive, they either produce sin or they produce the righteousness of God. And so that means I've got to take a very, very careful, I've got to be a guard. What do I see? What do I hear? And again, we're going to see and hear things we can't control. But when we're talking about this, resist the devil, draw near to God, what are the things I intentionally put in front of my eyes, that I intentionally allow into my ears? Because that's creating a basis for desires to be drawn to. And especially with our children. We cannot control everything that they are going to see or hear. But their thinking is still developing. Their convictions are still developing. And they're getting counter messages. What are we allowing them in by the things that are our choice to see and to hear? Because even when I guard my thoughts, and even when I guard my eyes, and even when I'm aware of my presence, I'm still going to be tempted. Even when I've done all of that, still going to be tempted. And yet, I can be armed, I can be prepared to face the temptation and to find the way of escape. Last, we find the way of escape by accepting God's will, accepting God's help. In Luke 22 and verse 42, Jesus prayed, "Father, if it is your will, take this cup from me." Again, to use the language of Matthew 6, "Father, lead me not into temptation." But then, of course, Jesus prayed that essential part, "But not my will, but yours be done." We don't even know all of the temptations that were presented to Jesus as he drank the cup, but he escaped them all. God's will was done. God's will was accomplished. And so Jesus gives us, how do I find the way of escape? Well, I accept the Father's will, whether that be being led to the temptation, in the song that we sang, the third verse, "Should thy mercy send me sorrow, toil, or woe, or should pain attend me on the path below? Those are occasions of various trials, but those are occasions where we will meet temptations. And the songwriter here describes that, God, your mercy sends me to these difficult occasions. What are his purposes? His purposes help us to accept his will. Jesus faced them. When God leads us there, again, we don't fight against him or question him, but in all things, 1 Thessalonians 5:18, in all things give thanks. And this song had a well-written way of reminding us to do that. Before the temptation, we give thanks to God. After the temptation, it's important to give thanks to God. And maybe that's easy to slip from my mind. God, help me, God, help me, God, help me. And do I remember to thank God like that one leper? Do I remember to thank God after he helped me, after I had to drink the cup and it was bitter, but he helped me? Do I go back and thank him? If I will, this also will help me in the next trial and in the next temptation. Expressions of gratitude prepare us to recognize the way of escape. And last, accepting God's will is a part of commitment to or maintaining our confidence that God is faithful. He's always willing to deliver us from evil. Again, in that process, he led some people to the Garden of Gethsemane. He led some people into the wilderness. But when he led them there, they were ready. He was supplying every need that they had. God was faithful. He knows what is good for his weak and still learning and his dependent little children. He knows. And so we find the way of escape by maintaining our confidence that God is faithful. And so we accept his will. Plenty of things catch us by surprise. Nothing catches God by surprise. He strengthens us, is willing to, before the temptation. He'll strengthen us. He'll provide the way of escape. If we choose not to take the way of escape, but then we bring our failure to him, then he'll forgive us, and in that he's strengthening us. So, again, nothing catches God by surprise. He has a plan for every part of trial before and during and after it. And he provides us all that we need to find the way of escape. Let's be confident that we are prepared for today and for tomorrow without knowing what they bring. As we sing number 344, the way of escape is available to each one of us, regardless of where we are today. We need the way of escape in order to abide in Christ and serve him today. If we have become Christians and failed in our faithfulness to him, then God wants to strengthen you today if you'll bring your sin to him and appeal to him through the blood of his Son. Then he will strengthen you. And if you don't have that strength because you're not in Christ, you need to remember that. You don't have many reminders of that. Being together is a reminder of that. And if we can help you in beginning your life of faith and hearing you confess that faith, and by that faith in the working of God, being baptized into Christ, we urge you not to wait, but to seek his help, the way of escape, and to tell us how we can help as we stand and sing.